Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today we meet the Naked Chef, also known as Jamie Oliver. And he tells us how a friend calling in sick kicked off his career, and he shares his new project. It's an imaginative way of giving back. Food writer Sally Schneider talks the world's priciest spice, saffron. Novelist and wine expert Jay McInerney has cliff notes for the wine lover. Then Gourmet Magazine's New York restaurant critic Jonathan Gold has essential information. Where to get the best pastrami sandwich in the entire country. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So guys, what's the latest find?
Lynn, we were eating ourselves silly in Memphis, which is a great place to do that. But we were in need of some medication. We ate so much, we found Champion Pharmacy on Elvis Presley Boulevard. We pushed in the front door, and this is what we heard.
Yes, the West Nile virus is in and around Memphis. Ask me about a special mosquito ointment for bumps and sores made by me. Also, we have natural repellent.
What was that?
Oh, wait a minute, Lynn. There's more.
This is Dr. Charles A. Champion. I'm a pharmacist and herbalist in Memphis, Tennessee.
Now, Jane and I have been eating around Memphis. We've eaten way too much barbecue. If I walked into your store and said, I don't feel so well, I ate 40 pounds of ribs in the last 3 days, what would you tell me I ought to do?
Well, one of the items that we sell that we've been real successful with is a product called Percy's Medicine that is made in Waco, Texas. This helps us sell the stomach, although it is designed for children. But we sell a lot of it to grown people. It's really an offshoot of a product that was on the market several years ago called Mississippi Cardia.
All right, guys.
Yes.
Tell me you ate here. Tell me what Mississippi Cardia is about. What is this?
Well, Champion's Pharmacy, which has been in Memphis a good long time, is the place to go for weird, unusual, and odd medicines as well as herbal products. Dr. Champion, who became a pharmacist in New Orleans many years ago, still stocks products like John the Conqueror root, Dr. Pure's Golden Metal Discover, the Cornhuskers lotion, Lydia E. Pinkham tablets for menopause, and just about any strange medicine that maybe your grandma used and you haven't seen on the marketplace for the last 50 years, Champion will have it.
My favorite medicine that he recommended to us for having eaten too many ribs was something that he called backdraft laxative. We did not buy any.
Oh, dear. But he sounds like such a generous soul.
A wonderful character. He's one of those people who just loves to tell you about what he does. He really believes in the power of the medications that he sells. And I mean, he sells, it's a normal pharmacy, and he will fill your prescription if that's what you need. But it really exists for those special needs that ordinary medicines won't handle.
Well, Jane, I know how you love drugstores, and you're always looking for things like scrunchies and those peripheral products. Does he have any stuff like that?
In the last 10 years, Tunica has gone from being a tiny little town in the Mississippi Delta to being a major casino, gambling, and gaming area. And Dr. Champion has voodoo casino spray that you spray around your room and soap that's Lucky Dice casino soap that you wash in before you go to the casinos in Tunica. So I stocked up on that.
Okay, you got that covered, but what were you eating in Memphis?
Memphis, of course, is one of the great barbecue cities in America. The pig sandwiches in Memphis are superb. The ribs are superb. It's a great place for plate lunch, meat and threes with fried okra and fried green tomatoes and squash and potatoes. But aside from all that, our greatest discovery, a place we never knew about before, is a place on Beale Street, called Dyer's. It's been there for 92 years, and the specialty at Dyer's is hamburgers. They have a very peculiar boast about their hamburgers, which is that these burgers are cooked in the very same grease that Dyer's has been using since it opened 92 years ago. They're very proud of this fact.
That they have never changed the grease.
Well, and they cook it. They have a great big old black skillet filled with grease, and sure enough, they just slip your hamburger patty into that grease, and out it comes a few minutes later. It's actually pretty delicious, and I was saying to the cook, I was saying, how can you do this? I mean, how can it possibly work for 92 years? And she said that what happens is they very scrupulously strain it every evening and always add more grease every morning, sort of like topping off your oil in the car.
I wonder if what they strain off, it goes into the backdraft medicine.
Well, that could be. But the fact is that they never actually change the grease. They use the same grease, only adding more as needed every day for the last 92 years.
And I have no doubt they're absolutely delicious, but now I know why you have to go to the Champion Drugstore.
Exactly. It's a matched pair.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Okay, Lynn. Take
Bye,
care.
Lynn.
Distance information. Give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find a party. Try to get in touch with me. Should not leave a number, but I've no place to call. Because my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall.
Gene and Michael Stern have a new updated edition of the classic guidebook Road Food. Every week, you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, spend some time. Look around. There's a ton of recipes. There's resources. There's the forum where you can get a chance to talk food with like-minded folks. And there's even a store. New things show up there all the time. The latest is a pasta and tomato lover's gift box. It'd be a great housewarming gift. So check out the site, splendidtable.org. Sally Schneider is my kind of food pro. She's a gifted cook who's always figuring out ways to have it all. Great tasting food that's good for you. Sally writes for national publications like Food and Wine, and she's the author of A New Way to Cook. Frankly, a book I think should be in everybody's kitchen. Hey, Sally, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn. I'm so happy to be here.
So what have you been working on?
I've been working on saffron, which is, as you know, the most expensive spice in the world, and also the spice that perfumes some of the most illustrious dishes in the world, like bouillabaisse and paella and risotto milanese.
Now, this comes from Spain mainly, doesn't it?
It does, Lynn. It comes actually from astonishingly humble and elemental origins. And that's what I start thinking about in October, because I've been to the saffron harvest, which occurs 2 or 3 weeks every October. I've been several times, and it haunts me this time of year.
What is it like?
Picture this. A really chilly, verging on cold, sunny fall day in the country. Trees have lost their leaves, landscape is drab, and you see a field of purple and realize that they are tiny crocuses, just like spring crocuses, only they are purple and coming up in cold weather. In each one of these are three crimson threads, which are the stigmas, which is the saffron. So they can only be harvested by hand, which is what goes on in Spain at this time of year, day and night, to harvest them. And you can imagine how long it takes to do this, which is why it's so expensive.
What does it taste like?
You know, I sat down one day to try to identify the flavors, and here's what I got. It is at once floral and pleasantly bitter, which is kind of an odd combination. Reminiscent of tobacco, hay, and cedar, nuances of pepper, citrus seed, and menthol. Now, it's kind of mind-boggling. Those are the words I was able to find, but it still doesn't do it justice, what the effect is. It's like a truffle. It is something totally other.
Is it the kind of spice that you should use in very simple dishes so that it really stands out?
It can go either way, from simple saffron butter on egg noodles, which is fabulous, to the complexity of a bouillabaisse or a sauce like a beurre blanc. It has an enormous range. It can go in breads, tomato sauces, garlic soup, leek soup, all kinds of rice dishes, starchy thing, you name it. It's really a fabulously versatile spice.
But before we go any further with the using, I realize we should back up a bit. How do you think we should buy saffron? What should we look for?
People get a little intimidated by it, buying it, because it's expensive, and then hence, you know, it can often be lesser quality is sold for expensive quality and so on.
Mm-hmm.
When you're buying saffron, first of all, buy whole threads, not ground, because ground can be adulterated, and like any spice, it loses its flavor quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Look for long, unbroken threads. They can be as long as 3/4 of an inch. Bright, deep red color with very few yellow threads. Those are the styles which have no flavor, and you don't want them. I also recommend buying saffron in quantity. They say in Spain that it lasts for 20 years, and in fact, because of that, they barter it like money. And the more you buy, the less expensive it is.
So what's your favorite way of using saffron?
My two approaches are this. One is to just be cooking rice with it and cooking everything with it. And to do that, you put some of a pinch or so of saffron in a little bowl, crush it with a spoon, and add some hot water and let it sit for a few minutes, and that will release the flavors of the saffron, and then you can just pour it into whatever you're cooking. But my real favorite way of using it is to make a saffron oil, which actually looks like a kind of wonderful crimson gold.
Mm.
And this is taking that basic procedure of steeping the saffron threads, which have been crushed, and then I heat a mix of 50% grapeseed oil, which has very little flavor, and extra virgin olive oil, which has a lovely flavor but in itself can overpower the saffron. And I mix it with the saffron and let it sit for at least 24 hours. And the flavor and color of the saffron will go into the oil. Now, this is not an oil you want to use for dipping. This is like having a flavoring essence on hand. You would drizzle a few drops into, say, a soup or a fish stew or a rice dish or beans or whatever. And if it has even a sauce, it will, the little beads will show on the top of the of whatever it is, and it's really beautiful, and you get a blast of flavor. The easiest, most dramatic way to use it is in a warm citrus and saffron vinaigrette, which is only this. It's an amazing sauce. You take a cup of orange juice or tangerine juice, boil it down till it's reduced by 50%, add about a tablespoon or a little more of the saffron oil, salt, pepper, and maybe a hint of lemon juice, and that's it. When it hits the plate, it separates. It has a beautiful mottled effect. Gorgeous colors on the plate, and on it I would lay grilled or roasted asparagus, roasted fennel, Vidalia onions, red peppers, poached or roasted fish, shellfish, lobster would be fabulous. I'm sure you get the idea.
It sounds fabulous.
It's really wonderful to have on hand.
Sally, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. You can get Sally's recipe for warm citrus and saffron oil vinaigrette on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, The Naked Chef Tells All. Jay McInerney has Cliff Notes for Wine Lovers, and we're going to have open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. You know, not so long ago, the idea of the chef as media star was laughable. But not anymore. We take our food and its creators pretty seriously. Consider that British import, The Naked Chef, also known as Jamie Oliver. Jamie's seen in 48 countries. He's sold millions of books. He's called the rock star in chef's clothing, and he's still in his 20s. Jamie's latest book is Happy Days with the Naked Chef. Jamie, welcome.
Hello, Don. How are you?
Just great. But Jamie, I want to go way back. Did you grow up in the food business?
Yeah. We lived in an old 15th century pub, kind of low ceilings, big fireplaces, kind of locals propped up against the bar. And my dad was, I didn't really realize until the last sort of 7 or 8 years really, but my dad was one of the first sort of food gurus that actually tried to put good food in old pubs, you know, local beer and good food. And, you know, after about 6 or 7 years, you know, it really started kicking off. So, you know, when I was like 8 and I used to walk down out of my bedroom in the morning, there were like 7, 8 chefs, you know, around, you know, whole venison being butchered and puff pastry being turned. And, you know, it was a real proper operation, sort of using local produce and stuff like that. And it wasn't anything big for me. It was just like breathing, really. It was like normal life.
So did you actually go to chef school? I mean, did you train?
Yeah, I went to, my dad kind of gave me a good grilling from the age of like 8 when I started wanting pocket money. He had me kind of, you know, picking up the, I was going to say fag butts, but that's not good over in America, is it? It's all the dog ends of the cigarettes. And where people used to eat out in the summer, they used to drop their cigarettes, and I used to have to go and pick those up. And then I did a big stint in the wash up, and then went into the kitchen. So I was working in the kitchen, and then kind of got into it quite a lot as I got older, sort of 13, 14, 15. Left school with pretty much nothing, apart from an A in art and a C in geology. And then, A in art and C in geology doesn't get you many jobs in England. And I thought, well, the only thing I'm really good at is my hands and cooking. So I went to Westminster College, which is a very old catering college. It's about 400 years old, really old building. Escoffier taught there, and it was a great course. It was 3 years. I travelled every day from Cambridge to London, and then kind of got into the industry and never looked back, really.
Well, how did The Naked Chef get started?
Well, that was a really bizarre thing. I was working at a fantastic restaurant called The River Cafe in Hammersmith, which is, I suppose, the only thing I can compare it to in America is like Chez Panisse, really.
Mm-hmm.
Two very inspirational sort of kind of hippified women called Rose Gray and Ruth Rogers. Basically, I was sort of one of the youngest sous chefs there. I was sort of 21. And kind of my dad had brought me up always to treat jobs as if it was my own sort of family business. So mm-hmm. I kind of did quite well there quite quickly. And I was loving it. And one day there was this film crew there. And it was my one day of the week off, and they called up and said, look, you know, Darren's gone sick. Can you come in and cover him? And, of course, my wife didn't want me to, but I'd grown up in the business, and I knew what pressure that put on the kitchen when someone goes sick and it kind of disrupts the whole flow of the kitchen. So I went in that night, and lo and behold, I was on the pasta section. It was a fantastic time of year. We had beautiful wild mushrooms, and I was, as you know, with the pasta section, things go in and come out quick. Mm-hmm. And dishes go from a pile of ingredients to a fantastic dish very, very quick. And the crew was kind of there and in my way, and I was kind of pushing them out the way and sort of just getting on with service, and it was all going off. And somehow I'd ended up in the program quite a lot, and the next thing I know, it'd gone out one night on telly. I didn't see it because I was working, and then the next morning I was working again, and the phones didn't stop ringing. It was just really surreal, and from there onwards, I suppose my nerves kind of carved out the look, shape, and eventually the name of The Naked Chef, which was, you know, basically I was never thought about telly. So because I was nervous, I just basically said, well, look, I'm only interested in doing this if I can do it, one, at my house, two, on real occasions, and three, with real friends and family, and go shopping with the people that I use in the restaurant and the local market people. And it kind of took about a year to convince everyone to do it, but obviously it was worth it, I think.
I think so, too. And the approach to food that you have intrigues me, because it's very real.
It was quite tough, actually. I've got to be honest, darling. It was, you know, I was on a journey, you know, and I still am. I was talking about only things I did know what I was talking about. I never pretended I knew it all. I didn't wear the chef whites because I felt that was a barrier between me and the public. And even though I was young and possibly struggling against the whole testosterone-y sort of, you know, I wanted to impress people type thing, mm-hmm. that I think lots of young boys do want to do, my real motivation was just to get the public to want to cook, really, period, end of story. Mm-hmm. And I honestly never ever, I didn't even understand the concept of overseas sales or kind of publishing in other countries. But of course, you know, 5 years on and 55 countries later and 18 translations later, it's kind of, it's a bit crazy.
Yeah.
Very crazy.
You have a new baby.
Yes, Poppy.
How old
Poppy
is she?
Honey Oliver. Oh, she's gorgeous. She's 7 months old. And she just started saying dada. And she's just gone on to food. She's got, she loves her butternut squash and her sweet potato and her peas and mint. And I try and use a lot of soft herbs in her cooking as well. And I'm kind of getting it more chunky now. So, and she's probably the most honest customer that I've got. If she don't like it, she spits it out. it's great. She's such a beautiful girl and obviously massively life changing for myself. You know, completely put a lot of things mm-hmm. in perspective and work wise and kind of emotionally as well.
What's next for you?
I've been working on this amazing project for the last year, and it's kind of, it's been draining the life out of me, to tell you the truth. I've set up a restaurant in London, which is going to be my first restaurant. It's called 15, and it's named after 15 kids that we, pick every 6 months, which is, basically the idea is that every 6 months we pick 15 unemployed kids that want to cook. We sent out 10,000 letters to the job centre. We had 1,500 kids turn up, just through tasting, talking, getting them to cook. We got them down to 15, and about 8 months ago, put them through an intense 5-month course. We then put them out into the industry for a month and a half into some of London's best restaurants. And then for 6 months, they come to me into our restaurant, which we've been building for the last year. And then after the 6 months, they go out of the country for 2 months to sort of work in another fantastic chef's kitchen. So I was just talking to Mario Bartelli yesterday, who's going to take a couple, and John George. And obviously I've got similar types of friends in Australia and New Zealand and Italy and France and stuff. So it's kind of, I suppose what you... You know, I've had a bit of a crazy 5 years. I think it's been very creative and mentally good for my cooking. And without sounding pretentious, I've, for a 27-year-old, I've kind of made a lot of money without it sounding too tacky. And I suppose this for me is about giving a little bit back, really.
Mm-hmm.
It might fail. I hopefully think it's going to succeed. You know, it's been so exciting. And... I've learned a lot from the students, funnily enough. You know, it's been a two-way thing. Certainly made me grow up a bit anyway.
Jamie, good luck and thank you.
Thank you very much, darling.
Jamie Oliver's latest book is Happy Days with the Naked Chef. You can see him on the Food Network every week, and you can get his recipe for the world's best baked onions on our website, splendidtable.org. If you ask novelist Jay McInerney what changed most in his life when his book Bright Lights, Big City turned bestseller, after The Money, he'll tell you he really got into wine. So much so that he now writes professionally about wine. He's the author of Bacchus and Me, Adventures in the Wine Cellar. Jay, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jay, I am coming to you for the cliff notes of the wine world. I need something easy. I don't have to read 10 books. When I walk into a wine store, I'll know what to buy. Can you help me?
Yes, I think we all want, if not expertise, then the appearance of expertise. And One of the rules I often start with, probably because it begins with an A, is my rule, avoid artichokes. It sounds kind of trivial, but a lot of good wines have been ruined by artichokes because they have an acid called cinerin, which generally makes all wines taste sweet and metallic and horrible. But a more applicable rule is my five-year vintage, great vintage rule, which I don't know why, but it seems that every 5 years or so, and in fact, precisely every 5 years, is a great worldwide vintage. 85, 90, 95, and now the year 2000 being the most recent examples. It's pretty bizarre, really. But it's an easy thing to remember.
Well, now wait, does this apply to wines all over the world?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously there are one or two exceptions. If we take in the entire wine world, which now is very, very large indeed, including countries like South Africa and New Zealand and Hungary, but yeah, pretty much. 1990 was just spectacular, just about everywhere in the world. The year 2000 has been very good in most parts of the world.
Okay. Any help for me, the great lover of Italian wines?
Yes. Well, I've got a rule. I don't know why, but it seems to me that every Italian wine that ends in Aia, that is A-I-A, is really spectacular. Now, this sounds really arbitrary, but I can trace the genesis of this rule. In fact, there is a very famous wine, a so-called Super Tuscan, which the Marchese Antonori started making about 20 years ago, called Sassicaia,
mm-hmm.
which became a legend. And I suspect that because this wine became so famous, others followed. We have, for instance, Ornellaia, Salaia, Lupicaia, Brancaia, mm-hmm. Tassinaia, Piastraia, and just since I compiled this list, I imagine there's about seven or eight more that have popped up, because everybody, of course, is trying to capitalize on the fame of this particular wine. But the fact is that they're all grown in the region of Bulgari, which is on the western edge of Tuscany, and it's really quite spectacular country for Cabernet Sauvignon. So keep that one in mind.
Okay.
I have a similar rule. A similarly easy rule that applies to American Zinfandel. I don't know why, again, there's no particular rationale for this, but it seems to me that almost any Zinfandel that starts with the letter R is good.
R.
We have the pioneering American Zinfandel Ridge, which is just, Ridge is a great winery. They also make Montebello Cabernet Sauvignon, but their Zinfandels are spectacular. I particularly recommend their Lytton Spring Zinfandel. But we also have such wonderful makers as Raffinelli, Ravenswood, Rabbit Ridge, Rosenblum, Renwood. And again, this list grows almost every day because Red Zinfandel is one of the great growth categories of California red wine.
This reminds me of the drug companies that name things with a P or a Z, so everybody follows suit. But any more wise counsel for us, something that we should really remember?
My final rule is the one that I call "Don't try this at home." I love red and white Burgundy, but my advice is, unless you're prepared to misspend years of your life and thousands of dollars, stay away from Burgundy, the Côte d'Or, because to my mind, it's a source of more heartbreak and tears than country music radio. Every time I think that I know Burgundy, I have a string of three or four bad bottles, and my accountant calls me to ask what's happened to my bank balance. So be forewarned.
Jay, thank you.
My pleasure.
Jay McInerney's latest book is Bacchus and Me, Adventures in the Wine Cellar. Every culture has its dining institution, the Italian pizzeria, the Japanese noodle house, and the Jewish delicatessen. Now, if you're not from New York or Los Angeles, you may not know about the debates that have split families and threatened friendships. Which city has the better Jewish delis? Now, to examine this issue further, we turn to Gourmet Magazine's New York restaurant critic and the award-winning food writer, Jonathan Gold. Jonathan organized a Jewish deli panel at the University of Judaism's Yiddish Culture Festival in Los Angeles. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Jonathan, what's a New York restaurant critic doing with a panel on Los Angeles Jewish delis?
Yeah, I'm a Los Angeles guy. I grew up going to delis in Los Angeles. And there's always been this sort of inferiority complex. You know, guys who grew up in New York kept talking about the grail of delis being, you know, the Carnegie and the stage and the celebrity, where the pastrami was wonderful and the herring was so delicious it would make you plots. And when I finally got old enough to start going to New York a lot, I ate in all these delis, and it occurred to me that the delis I'd grown up going to were actually better.
Oh, my. That must have been quite stunning. Did you tell New Yorkers about this?
Well, sometimes you're afraid to tell New Yorkers about this. But there's one particularly wonderful deli in Los Angeles called Langer's. It's in a district of L.A. called Westlake Park, just west of downtown. And it may have been a Jewish neighborhood in the 40s, but it probably hasn't been in, you know, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
This deli makes the most wonderful pastrami sandwich you have ever tasted in your entire life. They take a special cut of meat. There's all kinds of places you can get a pastrami from, but they get like the very center, the very fattiest part of the beef belly.
Mm-hmm.
And they steam it for several hours longer than most people do it, and they hand slice it. Instead of putting it on the machine to get really thin slices, you get like these sort of like slabby blocks of pastrami, and they put it on this, you know, wonderful sort of double-baked bread that's like really hard and crusty on the outside and soft and scented with those seeds on the center, and it's heaven. It's absolute heaven.
Is this how you judge a deli, by the pastrami?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the delis have all kinds of things. There's, in Los Angeles, for example, you can't have a deli unless you have Chinese chicken salad. Why this is a deli thing, I don't know. It's L.A. In New York, delis tend to have things like pastrami, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. An abomination, but, you know, you can't go to a deli in Brooklyn or Queens without running into it. But the pastrami sandwich is the center of it. Delis started out as places where you go, you get a pastrami sandwich, you get a pickle, you get some potato salad, you get a, you know, glass of black cherry soda or cream soda, and that was it. That was a deli.
So, all right, I've got a tough one for you.
Sure.
If I say to you, you can only eat at one deli in New York and one deli in Los Angeles, where would it be?
Well, of course, I would sit down in a deli seat and cry. But the deli seat in New York I'd probably sit in would be at Katz's, which also has hand-cut pastrami. Very good, like unusually smoky. And it's a complete New York experience because there are waiters, but the total Katz experience is you walk up to the counter and you go to the guy who's slicing the meat, and you bribe him to give you a good sandwich. He says something like, you take care of me, I take care of you. You put a couple bucks in his jar, suddenly you have a big, magnificent pastrami sandwich. If you don't, you get a mingy little thing like you get in coach class.
Okay, where in L.A.?
And that would be Langer's, which has, you know, the pastrami sandwich to end all pastrami sandwiches. Even Mimi Sheridan says it's the pastrami sandwich to end all pastrami sandwiches, and who of us is going to argue with Mimi?
Good point. Hey, Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, Mimi Sheridan is a formidable restaurant critic and food writer. Now, Jonathan Gold, on the other hand, is also formidable. He's the New York City restaurant critic for Gourmet Magazine. You can find Jonathan's two deli picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. This week's question is, what is an alligator pear? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. From Einstein bagels and Starbucks coffee to Cheesecake Factory cheesecake, Super Target, working to find a meal solution for you from breakfast through dinner. You can visit them online at target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be getting to your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Now, the question was, what is an alligator pear? Well, the answer is it's an avocado. Alligator pear is the old name for the fruit, obviously not the choice of a marketeer. Now, it was dropped out of fashion in the 1920s, and it was replaced by avocado. Now, avocado translates as lawyer in Spanish, but the name for the fruit is really just a modern rendition of an old Aztec title that was given to the fruit. Now, I've discovered a couple of things about avocados. First of all, they hate to be cooked. Their flavor fades. And the other thing is they love anything that's creamy or sweet. Now, you can mix up a little history and have a real interesting way of using avocados. Aztecs mashed them with chilies and lime. The Spanish explorers who found them put sugar or honey on them. Now, my friend Sam Arnold mashes avocados the way the Aztecs did, with chopped jalapenos and lime juice. And then he mixes up that mash with something sweet and creamy, namely vanilla ice cream. Now, I know it really sounds odd, but it's delicious. So I'm putting my improvisation of this on the website. It's a recipe called Sweet Avocado Green Chili Ice Cream. Give it a try. We're opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We've got Jane on the line. Jane, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I was at our local Armada farmer's market, and I saw tomatillas. My daughter is having a family gathering before my parents leave for Florida. And instead of Italian, our usual, she decided to go with Mexican.
Uh-huh.
So I bought a half a bushel of tomatillas, and now we want to know what to do with them and how we can preserve them.
Oh, my.
We had one of our clients made us soup with tomatillas, and that was delicious. But there has to be other things to do with them.
Well, yeah. Do you are you in the food business that you have clients?
No, actually, we cut hair. Chris and I cut hair. We do a lot of networking while we're cutting hair.
I see. I come to you for a haircut, and I can pay.
I get a recipe.
I see.
You can buy artwork. We also display art in the shop.
Can I pay with my food?
We could exchange. We sure could.
Well. Okay, now you want to know what to do with all the leftover tomatillo.
Right.
Right, okay. Well, first of all, there's the salsa. And that's a case, and there's a lot of versions of this. But what comes to mind is fresh chilies, the tomatillo, onion, lime juice, fresh cilantro.
Okay.
And you chop up those tomatillos, and you don't have to seed them. Unless you want the salsa to be a little bit on the drier side.
You have to cook them. That's what I want.
No, no, they're great raw.
Okay, all
right.
Oh,
no, they're super raw.
Okay.
And the idea is you would toss that with chopped chilies. And you know what's nice with something like this is to use like a combination, like some Anaheim chilies, which tend to be mild, and something like a serrano or a jalapeno, which tend to be hot.
I bought some jalapenos at the market.
Great. Okay, chop up those jalapenos. And if you want to tone down the heat, get rid of the seeds. Otherwise, leave them in.
Okay.
Okay? And I'd say, you know, taste your way through this. And then what I do is you chop the tomatillos, you chop up some onion, and you sprinkle it all with some lime juice, and you have chopped cilantro that you fold into it. And you can use it as a dip. You can put it, you can fold that into omelets. You can put it over finished dishes. And one of the things I do with it is I dress salads with it. I add a little olive oil, you know, if I've got leftover salsa. Okay. And I'll toss it with a salad that has avocado and grapefruit in it and lots of greens.
Okay.
So that's one direction you can go. Now, there's a couple of really great Mexican authors out there. I mean, people who are writing about Mexican food who are dynamite. And two of them that come to mind are Rick Bayless and Diana Kennedy. And anything by them is going to be, the recipes will be great, and it's, and you're going to have great flavor. And I know Rick has some great sauces and other dishes with tomatillos. So okay. I'd say look, you know, just drop in at a bookstore and thumb through anything by Rick Bayless, anything by Diana Kennedy.
Well, my niece Annie's coming in from Chicago to help my daughter with the menu.
Right.
She's bringing in fresh tortillas that are going to be fresh
made. Oh, these are going to be fabulous.
And she has many students that are going to give her recipes from their native homeland, Mexico. So
you're going to have a ball. And just make a huge batch of the salsa.
Okay.
And, you know, there's one other thing that's great to throw in. You can just do another version of the salsa. Add to it some chopped jicama and chopped orange or grapefruit sections. Or grapefruit sections. Add that to the mix. So you'll have two different kinds of tomatillo salsas.
Okay?
Okay?
That sounds wonderful.
And have a great party.
We will.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's up next? We've got Marlene calling. Marlene, what pressing issue?
I've come across a term that I have never seen before, and I'm so curious about it. I brought home from the store a bottle of olives
right.
to use for my martinis.
Right.
And on the label, it said Spanish throne olives, THROWN. Throne. And I had wonderful visions of people in the Spanish olive groves tossing these things at the adobe walls before they bottled them or pelting them at the passing sheep or something.
I love the image.
What in the world is a throne olive?
I have never heard of it.
Well, thanks a lot.
I'm sorry. You know, here's where, this blows the expertise image right out the window.
It sure does.
Now, are they cracked in any way?
No,
are they bruised?
They're perfect. They're large and plump, and as I remember, I don't have the bottle now, but as I remember, they were pimento stuffed. And I have no idea what this is.
I don't either. I mean, if they look like they were lightly crushed, which sometimes happens.
Or salad olives or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Then we would say, yeah, they've been hurling them, they've been stomping them. You know, I'm gonna wish you on a colleague of mine.
Oh, really? Which colleague is this?
Well, no, what I'm thinking is one of the great olive mavens in this world is Ari Weinschweig, who is part of Zingerman's. He's one of the owners of Zingerman's, you know, the great mail order house and deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I know they have an 800 number. And I think you should call and say that Lynn Rossetto Casper suggested that you talk to Ari, because if anybody is going to know the answer to this, it's going to be Ari.
And you're going to leave your listeners hanging here.
I know. Well, you know what? What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to report back to us.
Okay.
I'll do research, but call Ari. He's the nicest guy. Now, he's out of the country a lot, you know, tracking down good stuff. But he's going to probably know. And the other person that might also be helpful is one of his partners named Mo. Who's, both of these, by the way, are sweet guys. You're going to love them. But will you call us back?
Sure.
I'm going to do some hunting, but I've spent a lot of years looking at olives, and I've never seen the term.
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of years, I hate to mention how many,
drinking martinis
food.
And olives, right?
And when you come up with a term you have never run across before in the
throne?
Food world, it kind of brings you up short.
Marlene, you have stumped the chef.
Do I get a prize for that?
You know, we'll work on this.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Throne olives. I've heard cracked. I've heard crushed. I know of olives that are literally bounced on, but I have never run into thrown olives. We'll see what she finds out. And Ari's going to adore me, and so is Mo. Okay, call us, guys. 800-537-5252. 52. And let's see now, who's up next? We've got Molly calling. Molly, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about roasted chilies. My sister and I always run the Race for the Cure in Denver, and our ritual is to go buy a bushel of roasted chilies.
Oh, yeah.
So we're looking for interesting ideas of what to do with those beautiful plump ones that we don't want to throw in a bag in the freezer. They're too good to give away.
Right. And these these are generally roasted poblano chilies. And they're kind of a heart-shaped chili.
Mm-hmm. Different ones. We've gotten poblanos and Anaheims and sandias, different ones.
Brother.
And some are really hot and some aren't.
Well, and so you want some ideas of what to do with them?
Yeah, with the ones that are just so beautiful and plump and you feel like you should do something with them on the spot or stuff and freeze them for later.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, I mean, there is the classic stuffed chili. It's the chili rellenos,
mm-hmm.
where it's stuffed with a cheese mixture and it's fried, or some people just bake it if you don't want to fry it.
Right.
And that's classic. But, you know, one of the things, I'm remembering a wonderful dinner. There's a guy in San Antonio, Texas, named Rond Bechtol. And he's an architect and also a food guy. This man cooks like an angel. And when he was visiting the Twin Cities, he did this dinner for us. And I'm remembering, and again, I'm not remembering exactly, so Ron, forgive me. But I remember he roasted some fresh chilies, and I want to say that he marinated them with orange juice and garlic. Yeah. Very lightly. You know, not for a long time. And uh-huh. then he stuffed them with a mixture. I may be mixing up two dishes, but still this would probably be sensational. Sautéed wild mushrooms.
Okay.
You know, like sautéed shiitake and oyster mushrooms
uh-huh.
and chanterelles. And if you sauté them with some garlic and some really nice chili like ancho, or if you want hot,
uh-huh.
you could go for something like a mulatto chili.
Okay.
Which also tends to be that chocolatey quality.
Okay.
And anyway, garlic and orange zest. And a little white wine poured over that and boiled off, and then stuff that into the chili and then crinkle a little bit of queso fresco, you know, some fresh Mexican
right.
cheese on that, and serve that just like that, you know, at room temperature. I think that could be just sensational.
That sounds delicious.
And you know what else I'd put in there? I just realized I would put into that toasted pine nuts.
Okay.
For crunch.
That sounds great.
I think you've got something there.
All right.
You can play with it.
It's a winner.
Hey, and congratulations on running for the cure.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252, and we'll talk. We've got Paul calling. So, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am fine.
I had a question. I was thinking about it. I have a nephew that just found the word garbanzo funny as all get out.
Well, it is a funny word when you think about it, isn't it?
But now that's his favorite vegetable.
Garbanzo?
Yes.
Oh.
And he's only like 8. And so I was wondering, what else can I do other than the obvious, you know, hummus and a salad? Can I do with the garbanzo bean?
Oh, boy. You're talking to a garbanzo fiend here. I adore them. Okay. How can I count the ways of how I love garbanzo beans? You're roasting vegetables. Okay. Now, for a youngster at 8, I'd roast carrots, because roasted carrots taste like nothing on earth. Cut the carrots into bite-sized pieces. Toss them with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and some coarse chopped onion. Get your oven up to about 400 degrees. All right. And throw them on a shallow hot pan so they're spread out, and throw 2 handfuls of canned garbanzo beans in there. And what you do is you're going to roast them until the carrots are browned and sweet and tender, and they're going to be like sugar, and you're going to stir them every so often, and the garbanzo beans are going to pick up some of that flavor. And then what you're going to do is you're going to take them out, and if you want to, you can sprinkle that with lemon juice, or you can just eat it with a spoon. And you can fold it into rice if you'd like. It's delicious, because the garbanzo beans with the sweet carrots taste like nothing on earth. You can make garbanzo salad. You can mix the garbanzo beans with chopped up onion and fresh herbs like fresh basil and a little roasted sweet pepper. And you just give that to him, and you can put it on a bed of lettuce if you want, or you can just eat it the way it is. The other thing is that you can puree the garbanzo bean to make like a hummus, but instead of putting in the usual ingredients.
Right.
Put in orange zest, and I would put in a little roasted red pepper and some tomato, okay? And again, fresh basil and just a hint of lemon juice. And as a puree, and you give him colorful chips of some kind, or better yet, raw vegetables. Like, you know, paper thin slices of carrot, some celery, that kind of thing, and just pile it on and let them go to town on that with chips. Stew them, you know, like green beans sauteed with garbanzo beans and cooked in a tomato sauce until the beans are really soft and tender and the garbanzos are just picking up all that good flavor. That's another thing you could do that he might really like. If he likes spaghetti and tomato sauce, cook your green beans in a tomato sauce with the garbanzo beans. An onion, just a bit of onion. See, you think he'd like that?
I think that would be something he would go for.
And you know what? You could even put it over pasta if he's a pasta fiend. Pick
very
whatever
much.
Carb he likes and put the garbanzos in some way, shape, or form over it.
I mean, he's happy with just taking them right out of the can and then eating.
Well, that's great, and they're good for you. And gosh knows they've been around since biblical times.
Exactly, and it's the whole family's just like, he's four and he likes garbanzo.
This is a good thing.
That's something we normally skip over when it comes to a salad bar.
Well, there you go. And, you know, this is the beginning of perhaps him becoming a legume fiend. I like it. I hope this helps.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought. Since those olives stumped me earlier in the show, it makes me think of this quote from Thomas Jefferson. He said, "The olive tree is surely the richest gift of heaven. I can scarcely expect bread." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here and more can be found on the website. The address is splendidtable.org. It's such a well-rounded site. It has a forum for you to meet other intriguing food people. It has an enormous recipe box, and it even has a store. Check it out. All the proceeds go to support the program. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week, and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.